Tonight we're repeating the 1970 production of The Bagman, or The Impromptu of Muswell Hill, by John Arden. In it, in the form of a dream, some of the problems facing a socially conscious playwright in our time are described. Here then are Alan Dobie and Sheila Allen in The Bagman, or The Impromptu of Muswell Hill.
Upon a Thursday afternoon, it being half-closing day, I set out from my house along Muswell Hill Broadway in search of an evening newspaper. It was too early for the street corner sellers to have set up their little placards. The newsagents were shut, and a wet northwest wind was scuttling between the houses. Upon the top of Muswell Hill, I stood alone and felt quite ill. Without the Standard or the News, what could I do of any use? No word could I get of peace or war. So who was I? Where was I? What was I for? If one had asked me my name, I freely could have told the same. John Arden, 38, of ancient family. Writer of plays for all the world to see. To see and pay for, and to denigrate. Such was my work since 1958. I could not boast like Cicero that I had saved the state, nor yet like Catiline that I had tried my fiercest best to have it all destroyed. If on this soggy Thursday I should fall down dead, what of my life and death would then be said? He covered sheets of paper with his babble. He covered yards of stage cloth with invented people. He worked alone for years, yet was not able to chase one little rat from underneath the table. The rats would eat the cheese. The cats would eat the rats in convenience and ease. They would not notice any difference for Arden's sudden disappearance. There was no reason why they should. So I walked alone to Highgate Wood. Here, in the cold park, I wrapped my overcoat about me, sat down upon a bench, and tossed breadcrumbs to the squirrels. The dead leaves blew between my feet and the stumps of the trees. The red buses at my back rumbled backwards and forwards out of sight upon the main road. And the children were all at school, so their playground was quite empty. As I sat there, I fell asleep, and as I slept, I dreamed a dream. Or rather, it seemed that the dream rose up at me from out of the rain-darkened sandpit in the deserted children's playground. It piled itself up so very quickly in a turbulence of sand and torn scraps of cigarette papers. It had something the shape of a dirty old woman, not quite in her right mind. She was asking me if I would buy from her some white heather or some clothes pegs.
White heather?
She was a nuisance there. I didn't want her.
Clothes pegs?
Go away. No, don't want anything. Thank you.
White heather brings good fortune.
I've had good fortune. All too soon.
And wooden pegs will hold it fast so that it will not fly away. Peg down the luck you catch today, and you will have it yet tomorrow. Peg down your joy, peg down your sorrow, Examine them when you have time. Weigh the other against the one. You will not know what you can do until you know what you have done.
You're beginning to be tiresome. Go, get you gone, portentous, oracular, condemnatory old hag.
I'll tell you what. How would you like a beautiful, useful canvas bag? It's yours for 10 shillings with whatever it contains. It's pig in a poke, in fact. All my young gentlemen take great delight to put at risk a few bob on a lucky bag the like of this. Why, it's only last month I sold just such a one to a courageous lad from overseas, and he opened it up directly, and what did he find?
Well, what did he find?
He found such an elegant, soft young woman with golden skin like olive oil and black hair down to her sweet haunches as bright as melted bitumen. And she became his private property forevermore without regrets. What do you think to that, then?
Most improbable.
True.
Whether true or false, it was temptation. I was in a mood for fornication. And also I was I not in a dream? Where women are always exactly what they seem, instead of being no better than they are. In any case, I thought, I would not go too far. Open the bag. Take just a quick peep. Put in my hand. Make a tentative grope. If I did not like her, I could quickly shove her back. Tie up the strings again around the mouth of the sack. For some fresh, brief sexuality which might prove very nice, 10 shillings did not seem to me an inordinate price. You don't mind a lot of small change?
Oh, no, sir. It's convenient, really. There you are, sir. Thank you.
So she fluttered away laughing and disappeared among the trees, as well camouflaged by her grime and tatters as were the fidgeting squirrels by their grey fur and rapid movement. Even the reverberation of her laughter through her 5 or 6 black teeth was closely akin to the tiny cursing of the squirrels, and I wondered who she was. But even more I was wondering what the devil it was I had bought from her. Surely I could never have been so foolish as to imagine there could really be a complacent, greasy concubine stuffed up in this very ordinary kit bag which she had dumped here at my feet. It had the British Army broad arrow stenciled on it in black, and what seemed to be a soldier's number, 2212-8480. I tried to lift it up. It was heavy enough, certainly. But whatever was inside it was pure dead weight, and had neither the shape nor the consistency of living flesh. Female, lecherous idiots for the use of. So I gave it a kick. Hurt my foot. Then I tried to unfasten the string. But the rain had soaked it, and all I succeeded in doing was to nearly break off a fingernail. I was about to have a go at it with my penknife and my teeth when I heard footsteps behind me. He had boots on his feet, and they crunched the dead leaves. I looked up at him under my armpit. Good God, how tall he was. He was hanging right above me, the way colliery winding gear would overhang the little streets of West Yorkshire where I was born.
Oi! You!
On his hat was a small brass badge. He was a park keeper.
I said you. What's in that bag, then?
I don't know.
Well, get it out of here. It's a thing.
Yes.
It's an article.
I suppose so.
It's an object of merchandise. You can't bring it in this park. You are a vendor.
No, I'm not.
And if you aren't, you are a gypsy or vagrant, or you're about to use the park for a purpose of immorality. And in any case, you are in a condition such as is offensive to other members of the public.
I most certainly am not. And what other members of the public? There's nobody else here.
That may well be your opinion. If you refuse to comply with the printed and posted regulations of the Great London Council, I fear I shall have no alternative but to take your name and address.
Yes, but...
Here is my notebook. Here is my pencil. Right then, we are prepared.
His pencil was enormous, stuck weapon-wise in his belt. It was the kind that carpenters use, over an inch broad and a third of an inch thick, almost a cubit in length, and his fingers tightened on the shaft of it till the knuckle bones sprang white beneath the skin. His book was the size of my grandfather's family Bible, loaded to the end papers with the names and addresses of all those who were accursed for that they lived in fornication, for that they were covetous and bore false witness, for that they moved their neighbor's landmark, for that they...
Go on, get out of it, and take your dunnage with you.
He had lifted up the great stave that he carried under his swollen elbow. It was a pike staff shod with steel. You could have murdered a bull with it, though for him it was but an implement for the removal of waste paper from the immaculate greensward. Like the steering oar of the Argo, he did poise it in the air, and so drove it with all his malice into the frayed canvas of my sack.
Oh, don't do that. You cause distress.
Get out of it.
So I went. He followed me to the gate. I looked round after I got out of the park, and there he was, standing. His cruel spike still uplifted in his hand like a sword of living flame, protecting the fenced garden, and the squirrels, and the birds, and the rabbits, and the prohibited fruit of the glade from the nonsense that was in my bag. So the question arose, what nonsense? I had heard it squeal when it was poked, but not the squeal of a woman. I was well aware by now that in that respect I had been deceived. At all events, this bag must hold something that was known to be obnoxious to the guardians of the public immunity. So I thought I would better not attempt again to open it until I was well out of sight of nosy Parkers, bureaucrats, and my fellow men in general. So I heaved it onto my shoulder and looked carefully to left and right in due dread of the passing traffic. But where was the passing traffic? Where, indeed, was the Muswell Hill Road, which should have run beside the park to the bus stop and the road junction and the Northern Line Underground? No road, no cars, no houses. All I could see was a wide, heathery, brackeny, bushy sort of moor, with clumps of dark trees here and there, and a trackway across it, a trackway which disappeared towards the south round the shoulder of a wet green hill. Highgate Hill? It might have been Mount Zion for as much as I could recognize. Beyond the hill, and several miles away, I could see a cloud of smoke, I supposed hanging over some small inhabited community. It was still raining, and it was cold. Bewildered by these circumstances and resentful at the weather, I began to walk south towards the smoke. Before I did anything else, I must find out where I was, when I was, who else there was, and why. This dream of mine that I had thought so fine was now becoming burdensome and made me mutter curses underneath my breath. It occurred to me it was no dream, but death. If it was death, why was I not afraid? Just mildly curious I was, and cross. Then I realized that the strange noise that came out of an overgrown hollow towards my left was not being made by birds. I went down between the bushes. Here there was a group of women kneeling and crouching round a man who lay on the grass. He was a long man in a black suit, full of holes and covered with clay. He was dead.
He was starved!
What else? With but bad nettles to boil up for his soup-chewing roots.
Growing grass between his teeth till his mouth water runs all green and his stomach swells out till it was ready to burst.
And it burst!
Who was he?
How should we know?
We just found him.
If we had strength enough, we would dig him his grave.
The man upon the ground was dead. Bent down around him, every head seemed more than half as dead as his. I saw their black and yellow eyes like rat holes in a river bank where deep inside the rats will wink and blink and grind their savage teeth. Four savage women ground their teeth. Splintered tent pegs or such cogs as millwrights cut from jagged logs, they crunched together. Then they swung their necks towards me, stared at me long, in silence stared, and then began at once and suddenly to scream and sing.
There he has it. There he has food in his bag. Tear it down from him. Tear it and grab it and drag. Rip off his fingers. By root and by sinew. Castrate him and break him and beat. For what he has got we can eat.
No, no, stop it. God, ladies, give over. No, please. But I didn't even know who you were. I haven't got any food. Here, you leave that alone. Help! Oh, my God, help me! They've gone mad.
Indeed, I had made quite sure that I was already a dead man. The four of them were swarming upon me like 400 furious bees let loose from an upturned hive. Then, suddenly, they were gone. And the ground all around where they had flung me was bouncing in my ears with the din of great horse hooves.
Are you right, boy? Left alive, are you? By Christ, but we came just in time.
He was a soldier of some sort. Well mounted and heavily accoutred in leather strapwork and brass buckles, big boots, a thick black club in his hand, 6 or 7 inch wide moustache across his face, face all but entirely concealed under the wide peak of a black leather helmet. He had half a dozen men with him, all equipped in the same style. As I rose to my feet, very vague, very battered, I could see them riding down the hill away from us, waving their truncheons, scattering the tattered women. They uttered their blows without remorse, by heavy stick and hoof of horse. Upon one woman's womb they trampled. She lay in the gorse all bloody and crumpled. But I was alive, and I would thrive. I'm alive. Yes, I think so.
I thank you. Oh, good God, but what a business. Who were they?
They were starving. Didn't they tell you? Oh, they have nothing better to do but rake the countryside for food, and so near are they to death, they care not a scratch for the death of any creature who will come between them and the sustainment of their bellies. This dead fellow on the ground here, had you not interrupted them, they would have eaten him, blood and bone.
But why is this happening? Has there been some disaster? Is there famine in the land?
Those who deserve to eat, eat. So what about you? What do you deserve? Where are you from?
I came from over there.
You seem well fed, decent class of a man, quiet, unlikely to give trouble to the honest and self-respecting populace. You intend to travel far?
To be frank, I don't know. I don't altogether know anything at all.
And that's as it should be. A confession of ignorance is more than halfway towards a fulfilled education. With fulfilled education, you take a fit place in responsible society. Aye, but it's no part of my duty to let you travel around here on your own. As you've seen, it's far from safe. So put up your bag upon the back of my saddle. Take a good grasp of my left stirrup. And when the patrol is reassembled, we will escort you into town. Oh, come along, then. Let's be having you. You've got them all on the run there. No point in bothering further. You can form yourselves up again upon me in column of rote. And then we can proceed.
The road we traveled was not good. Rocky and ruttered, clogged with mud. The land on either side was bare, with roofless cottages here and there. No travelers did we pass or meet, though once I saw the prints of feet, bare feet in the mud, as though some ragged man who had to go unshod upon this road had seen my escort and had fled between the thorny bushes out of sight. No doubt he crouched there in his fright until we were gone by. And then, where three roads met, we came upon a leafless tree. To the trunk was nailed a living man who screamed and railed.
For the freedom of the people! For the freedom of the people. For the freedom of the people. Oh, the starving men will live, and the well-fed men will rot among the maggots of their own engendering. For God's sake, somebody, give me a spoonful of water.
No, we ride past him. He's nothing. He don't signify. He'll be dead by tomorrow.
But who is he?
Like I told you, he's just nothing. Take a look down the road ahead as we cross over this bluff. You'll get your first clear prospect of the town. Huh? So what do you think of it? Well inhabited, and moreover well protected. It's my job to keep it so.
There was the town, and it was made of wood and thatch. A tall stockade of sharpened timber rose around the huddled houses, and the ground outside of this defense was scraped and scooped into a ditch. The moat was dry. There was a drawbridge and a gate. The leader of my escort gave a shout.
Oh! Oh! Oh!
The gate swung up. The bridge came down. We rode across into the town. Beside the gate, a sentry sprawled loose in the lap of a fat brown girl. He wore a flower in his ear. He did not seem to take much care upon his duty. In the air above him flapped a worn-out flag of tawdry stripes, rather a rag. The whole town could be said to be rather a rag. So slovenly, uncared for were the walls and streets.
And yet, the people whom one meets among these slovenly, uncared-for streets are fat and greasy, richly dressed, hung with jewels, their curls well-pressed, their necks and buttocks thick. Why, then, is all their town untidy and unclean?
Well, everybody is as rich as they are. Who's left to do the dirty work?
Well, you are you not?
Oh, no, we are not. We keep the peace, preserve good order. We have clean clothes and polished gear. Our breath don't stink. But then we're different, don't you see? We are of the town, yet not of it. In a well-swept corner, there we sit.
He pointed to a sort of compound on a hillock at one extremity of the stockade, fenced off very precisely in isolation from the rest. And there all indeed was neat and trimmed and whitewashed, with living quarters for both men and horses, a smart guard upon the gate, and nothing slovenly at all.
We are without the town, yet not outside. Day and night we march and ride, ranging the high ground and the low. Where all is desolate, we keep it so. These people live their scruffy lives because of us. We don't converse, we make no fuss. They only know that we are here. And knowing that, they know no fear.
Except of us.
Except of us.
Except of us. We make no fuss. We are quite content with what we do. Now here, I think, is a fit place for you.
And with a sudden twist of his foot, he kicked me sprawling through an archway into a large courtyard that opened off the street. He threw my bag after me and then clattered away with his men. It appeared to be a place of assembly, with benches of rough-hewn timber arranged in tiers upon three sides, while on the fourth side, opposite the entrance, stood a raised platform under the shelter of a long sheet of tarpaulin stretched upon poles. The benches were crowded with people eating and drinking and sweating in the warm sunshine. The rain was over, and I had begun to feel very hot. The smell in this courtyard was not at all agreeable. There was a good deal of pushing and shoving. I had hard work to keep hold of my bag, and I had more than a notion that many of those around me were thieves. Upon the platform, a pair of dancers were performing for their entertainment. One dancer was a woman. She tinkled little cymbals as she danced, and her long draperies swirled all over the platform. Her partner was a wild-looking, bearded man. He wore no more than a red-embroidered breech clout and a short leather waistcoat. In his hands were two sharp knives, with which he cut and tore at the draperies of the woman until she danced entirely naked. The people cheered and cheered at this progressive revelation. For myself, despite my earlier libidinous hopes in regard to the sack, I was more concerned in preventing my feet from being trodden on and my pockets from being picked than I was with the indecent excitement of the exhibition upon the stage. Then I became aware that the two dancers now prancing arm in arm like a pair of yoked chariot horses, had suddenly broken into song.
Seven cows were feeding, they were full and fat. Pharaoh lived in Egypt, he dreamed another dream. Seven cows came walking, they were long and lean. The lean cows up, the fat cows up, Pharaoh rolled around. Pharaoh hid his head then deep in the ground. Joseph, oh Joseph, tell to me my dream. If you cannot tell it, I must groan and scream. Joseph, oh Joseph, what does it mean? Joseph said to Pharaoh,
you are dead and gone!
Eat! Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you die.
The dancers had moved aside. Their place on the platform was now taken by a gray-haired, smiling, red-cheeked, soft-handed, dignified, benevolent gentleman. He wore a robe like an academic doctor and a chain of office round his neck. The people loved him.
Who is he?
Shh! He's the king's chief minister.
He seems a very popular minister.
The people love him.
He provides the entertainment, you see, from his own private fortune.
Just listen to the reception he gave.
I can hear it. And he enjoys it.
Oh, he does, yes.
How did he acquire his own private fortune?
How do you think? He inherited it like everybody else.
Ah.
But now the minister was making a speech.
And spice and all things nice. It's a beautiful afternoon. Look, the sun's come out at last.
And the way he went on, you would think he had brought it out himself.
Delightful young lady. Give her a bit of a slap and tickle.
This was the female dancer, undulating on the stage there, within 2 or 3 inches of the minister's gesticulating fingers. So he gives a poke to her cheeky plumpness, and then more than a poke. He doesn't spare himself in his indulgence. Then he claps his fat hands, and 2 little girls with big round eyes and many bangles on their wrists came tripping on with baskets. The baskets contained what appeared to be sweets, wrapped up in silver paper, and he tossed them in handfuls to the crowd, and the crowd scrambled.
Just for toffees? Such a scramble?
Only some of them are toffees, some of them are pearls and emeralds, and some of them are dried beans. It's very much a lucky dip.
Being a stranger, I thought it best not to join in the scrambling myself. But the man on my left was unwrapping a real pearl.
God be praised! God be praised! Look at that, sir! There's richness!
While the woman on my right was unlucky and got no more than a couple of dried beans.
Oh, the devil, I say, to hell with that! God, they were thrown to me on purpose!
While the scramble was taking place, the minister had gone, and the dancers had gone, and the little girls had gone too. The platform was now empty. Oh, but no, it was not. Here's a tall, stooping, meager-featured, mean-eyed, black-haired, hobbling, clothes proper for spoil sport, and he walks with the aid of a stick. He snarls from the platform as the enraged people snarl at him.
Who is he?
Shh! He's the king's chief minister.
But we've just had the king's chief minister.
No, no, this is the other minister who's not popular with the people. They always have to have the two of them. Stands to reason when you look at it.
Oh, yes! Yes, you may boo, and you may catcall, and you may make mock of my disabilities. But you know I know the real reason for your pretended scorn. Because I am the one, the only one in all this town, to have the courage and the self-respect to inform you of the truth about yourselves, of the perils that do confront you, and of the faults of character, through which you will be presently submerged by those same perils, if you do not look sharp about you and pull yourselves together. Oh, you improvident dross and floating motes of sad debauchment. Yes, I tell to you the truth. And as truth, it is not comfortable.
And as teller of it, I am hated. Well, do you want it or do you not?
No!
Are you going to let me speak?
No! No! No!
Silence! No! Silence, I say! Thank you. Now, listen to this. The horsemen on patrol this afternoon have brought a stranger into town. I don't like the sound of him, and I don't like his looks. If you all turn round, you will see him at the back there. There he is. And if you are half the man I take you for, you won't like him either.
It is not at all agreeable to be glared at by all the people. I do not hold that man to be wise who desires to be made the cynosure of all eyes.
You see? There he stands. And his face turns from red to white, and from white back to red again. Oh, yes. While you were all soaking up the voluptuous depravity so generously provided you by the munificence of my esteemed colleague, you failed to notice, did you not, that someone had crept in, that someone's eyes were popping out at the sight of the private nudities that had been supplied for you alone. That someone at the back there was irregularly experiencing a carnal enjoyment of what was yours and yours alone. And he asked you no permission. Come forward, sir. Come forward and make yourself known to this hospitable assembly. If you have a joke at the back, we would all be glad to share it.
The apologetic smile I was nervously assuming disappeared at once.
Or if you have a problem to be solved, perhaps we all can solve it for you. Make a gangway for the gentleman. Let him set himself up upon the platform. Up beside me, sir, if you please. Now, sir, face the people.
So I faced them. By God, I had no choice. They thrust me up there so violently that I twisted my ankle. And they giggled at me. Giggled and whispered. One or two of them threw tomatoes.
That's enough now, that's enough. Save your applause till the gentleman has performed. You will perform, sir, won't you? You will not disappoint us.
But I...
What is your name?
John.
Ah, he says his name is John. Do we think his name is John?
No!
Oh, dear, they don't believe you. So I wonder what your name is. Ah, he wears spectacles, does the little gentleman. He must be a gentleman of learning. Do you know what I think he is? I think he is a professor.
No, I'm not.
And just look at his little fingers. He has ink stains on his fingers. Professor Inkspot is his name, and a very good name for him, too. Shall we sing our little song to him? One, two, three, four.
Professor Inkspot, tell us now why you walk like a penguin sow, why your nose does root and dig into the earth like a grunting pig. Tell us, quick, or else he'll whack you with his stick.
Or else I'll whack you with my stick. There!
Ow!
And there again! Ah, so that's a foretaste. Now, explain yourself, and smartly. What have you got in that bag? More pens have you got? More bottles of ink?
I don't know why I should be treated with such disdain.
From my childhood ever, I had felt great fear of a crowd of strange men who would stare at me and jeer. But now, when confronted by just such a mob, for a moment, indeed, of all speech they did me rob. But then my sudden courage came out at them in pride. I would not be intimidated, and my heart I would not hide.
My heart I will not hide from you, nor yet what is in my sack. I am not to be put to shame, and all that I have I am ready to declare.
Very well, then. What is it?
Except that I don't know. Which is feeble enough, I agree with you.
So, open it up for us.
I can't untie the cord.
Ah, feeble-fingered idiot, use this knife. Oh. Now hold it up from the bottom and shake out whatever's in it.
Little men.
Little men? You're a little man yourself. So here is a little man with a bag full of little men. How many little men? Will you tell the people? Tell them loudly.
One, two, three.
Little men and little women. The largest of them, about 12 inches long, made out of wood, and carefully jointed and carved. Each one of them dressed in a characteristic costume.
Seven, eight, nine.
There was a soldier in a red coat, and a policeman, and a doctor with great spectacles, and a pretty little blonde popsy, and a blousy, soot-stained housewife with a baby at her breast, and a hideous old woman, and a robber with a great sword and bushy whiskers.
13, 14, 15, 16, no, I counted him already. 16, 17, 18...
Here was a king and a queen, and a bishop with a hooked nose.
18, did I say? I must have miscounted. I'll go back to number 12.
The funny thing was, I couldn't count them at all. My whole notion of numbers seemed to have got muddled up. So I came to a sort of compromise.
I can't count them exactly. It's the sunshine. It's too dazzling. But I suppose it'd be fair to say there are something between 20 and 30 of them. Attractive little people, don't you think?
I was still nervous of that stick.
But what are they for?
Ah, yes. What are they for?
I stood upon the platform with the bright sun bang in my eyes. I had a headache. Oh, God, in this confined courtyard, what a stink of overfed and belching bodies. And for what seemed many minutes, I stood there in a complete silence. A little flurry of wind had set the tarpaulin to rattle and to strain at his cords. And everyone in the crowded place was suddenly as still as death. When I spoke, I didn't speak with my own voice. Nor did it seem to me that I myself had composed the words that I uttered. But it was as though, curled up inside my belly, a very old and cantankerous dragon was growling and rating. And the sound came through my teeth.
My little people in a row, sit on the stage and watch the show. The show they watch is rows and rows of people watching them. Who knows which is more alive than which? If you fidget, if you twitch, blow your nose or nod your head, my little men, though made of wood, can frame a gesture just as good. Laugh and leap, or shake with terror, my little men will be your mirror. What you do or what you did from little people can't be hid. They will know it and reflect, instruct or jerk your every act. Your thoughts expressed in dark of night, they body forth in broad daylight. This soldier boy in coat of red is every one of you whose head is turned by dreams of power achieved through violence and the tears of the bereaved. This constable, so stiff and straight, is any man who thinks that right must stamp on wrong, till wrong can claim that right was twice as much to blame. And see, this bright-eyed girl, her bum round as an apple or a plum, she is any girl who will lie down, whether for love or half a crown, and rising up again will say, that's enough then for today. Do not expect as much tomorrow. This mother here, in joy and sorrow, becomes the mother of you all. Her baby from her lap will crawl and grow to be whichever one of you would he should become. Who is to say what stories these shall show you? You tell me who you are, and I will know you. And then you sit and watch, my little men, and you will know yourselves again, 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 again!
And no sooner were the words out of my mouth, good heavens, but I had reminded myself of Adolf Hitler at his worst, And what were people going to think of me, even these appalling people? No sooner were they out of my mouth than all the little men had leapt to their feet, and there upon the platform, without a moment's pause or hesitation, they had formed themselves up into two opponent groups. There was a small group of those in rich costumes, and a large group made up of the ragged and ill-favored. Straight away, the larger party flung themselves with rage upon the smaller, but were beaten back time and again by the valor of the soldier and the brutality of the constable. There was also some display of the duplicity of the bishop and the cruel faint-heartedness of the king and the queen. But in the end, the larger party were compelled to fall on their knees, abase themselves, and sue for mercy. Then the revengeful king decreed various punishments. The leaders of the rebellion were killed in hideous fashion, or flogged and tormented, or locked up in iron cages without food and water. Their cries so worked upon the spirit of their defeated comrades that a new conspiracy was set afoot. The king was assassinated, the bishop was beaten, the soldier and the constable were put to flight, and their overweening queen was dragged tumultuously through the mire. Such prisoners from the former rebellion as still survived their ill treatment were released and paraded as heroes. And in fine, a republic was proclaimed, and the victors of the Civil War rejoiced in their great deliverance. Yet all their efforts in the end were seen to be in vain. No sooner had they prevailed upon their sumptuous enemies than they fell to quarreling amongst themselves as to which of them should hold the sovereignty. The conclusion was ominous. Hacked and splintered wooden limbs lay everywhere upon the platform. And of those mannequins who were not dead, only the most crippled and the weakest seemed to have enough voice to bewail their ill fortune and to call upon the world for redress. None who watched were able to restrain their tears. The more so because all this time an unseen music had been ringing and clanging, stirring the heart and turning the entrails of all that spellbound auditory. So it has, and now it ceases. And when at last it fell silent, and my little people reassembled themselves, rose once again to their feet, and lifted their right arms in a gesture of courteous dismissal, there came a roar of spontaneous applause that shook the very boards on which we stood. Even the unpopular minister was smiling, in a thin and grudgeful fashion, mind you, but smiling he certainly was.
Most impressive. Educational. I am truly amazed, Professor, that upon so short an acquaintance with our community, you have been able to diagnose our weaknesses and discover our public perils with such acute perception. How much more salutary than the pabulum served up through the munificence of my esteemed colleague.
Your esteemed colleague, my dear sir, is entirely of the same opinion as yourself. Professor, I congratulate you. I have never known the people so delighted, so enlivened, so thoroughly stimulated both intellectually and emotionally as they have been this afternoon. Indeed, I think that you and I should have a little talk about some further demonstrations of the same kind, which I trust I may be able to prevail upon you to perform for us very shortly. You will stay with us for some time, of course. We can offer you the very best facilities for the exposition of your strange powers. No expense need be spared. In the meantime...
In the meantime, dear colleague, the people are getting impatient. There is business of state to be attended to in this assembly. Now that the entertainment is over... Brigands from the outside, who were captured by yesterday's patrol, have to be brought to trial, sentenced, and punished. And there are numerous new regulations for the security of the city that require to be debated and approved before His Majesty can issue them in the form of a decree.
But all this can be dealt with by junior members of the council. The professor here in his innovation must surely be discussed by you and me. Forthwith.
Whatever you wish. Rabble! Be silent! You have not been forgotten. Indeed, you are never forgotten.
The junior magistrates! The junior magistrates will attend to the next business. If my colleague and I may have your courteous permission to leave you in that job. Thank you very much. Professor, will you come this way?
As they led me from the platform, the meeting was called to order.
Citizens, if you please, I call this assembly to order!
By a red-faced, loud-voiced, sergeant-major type of man who had risen from his seat in the front row and was greeted by a shower of orange peel and apple cores and nutshells for his pains. I had gathered my little men into the bag and I followed the two ministers down a corridor into an antechamber. Here they left me to my own devices, with a bottle of wine and a plate of ginger biscuits. I sat there for, say, 10 minutes. I could hear their voices in the next room. I am sure I wasn't intended to hear, but some holes for ventilation had been left unstoppered up near the ceiling, and their words of necessity came filtering through.
No, you are altogether too indulgent. Oh, he has these powers, certainly, and considerable skill in their deployment. The question is, how much is him, and how much is his little men? Is it sorcery or conjuring? Does he mean to do it, or does it happen? We'll not find out how to deal with him until we know the answer to that.
I do not regard the answer to that as being at all important. Whether it is magical or whether it is calculated, it is perfectly clear to me that the whole performance was informed by the fellow's own personality. So we must act, must we not, as though he intended it all from the very beginning.
Very well. Let us do so. And precisely what did he intend? Subversive encouragement to insurrection and revolution? Setting up the cause of the outlandish men against the citizens? And quite amazingly, the citizens, or the greater part of them, applauded.
It was exciting as a narrative. You must grant it that. It had fast movement and helped them to forget it, as I do. Or else, like this professor fellow, we can occasionally remind them. Let them feel a temporary pang, and their discomfort is assuaged. Surely this has always been your technique. What's wrong with it so suddenly?
It is altogether one thing to make them afraid at rebellion and destruction. Quite another to have them urged in open daylight to feel glad that such violence can already be conceivably in contemplation. Put into their hand a knife with a sharp blade. Tell them this is for your heart. Would you rather have it in your throat? Do not forget to offer praise before you die for the skill of the knife grinder and the truth of his hand and eye. I ask you, is that politic? I tell you, no. It makes me sick.
Not altogether as stupid as you make me out to be. The story concluded, after all, with the complete failure of the rebellion to consolidate its achievements.
I did not consider it a logical development of the plot. And if I did not think so, there are likely to be others who would share my opinion.
But the fact is, they are well fed. They do not want to be otherwise. Look out of the window, my dear sir. Tell me what is going on.
I had no window in my room, but I could hear sounds from the outside.
Yes, yes, the brigands have been tried, now being put to death in the name of His Majesty. The Assembly is appreciating the act of justice. And so?
And so they are appreciating it. And their enjoyment of the execution is in no way diminished by the enjoyment of the recent spectacle, however subversive you may think it has been. In my view, the professor is a young man to be encouraged. Though, of course, we must be careful.
Oh, whatever you think best. We can encourage him by all means. And control him.
Not control. Suggest directions. That is all.
You will think me very stupid, but the significance of this conversation entirely passed me by. I was so tired, you see. I could hardly keep open my eyes. All I could think of was the power and the splendor of my little men, so newly revealed to me, so manifold in possibility, so outrageously out of proportion to the amount of actual work I had done. They had been absolutely given to me, from where I knew not, and by whom I knew not. But it appeared that they were mine, and I alone was capable of inspiring them into their motions. After a little, the two ministers returned. They spoke to me in soothing voices. They promised me this, that, and the other.
Peace and quiet. Agreeable surroundings.
Appreciative audiences.
Plenty of opportunity for experiment. Unlimited funds at your disposal.
Yes, for any small personal gratifications appropriate to your status amongst us, only say the
just
word.
Just say the word, my dear fellow. Just say the
but
word.
But I think I had already fallen asleep. There was some sensation of being led or carried through one room and then another, and of being laid upon a bed. At any rate, there was a bed, and I was on it, and I slept. Yet even asleep I still did keep the cords that tied my precious bag tight in my grasp, lest one should drag it from me secretly by night. Mistrustful I was. I was quite right.
What is this cord you grip so tight?
This cord?
You clench with all your might your little fist. I cannot prize it open like a dead man's eyes.
Yep. Oh, so I've caught you.
Let go of my arm. You're hurting me, please.
No. You first tell me what you're doing here. Putting out your hand in the dark to grab hold upon my bag, but you grabbed hold upon me, and I've got you. So explain yourself and no nonsense.
Perfectly happy to explain myself, sir. But keep your voice down. There may be other people awake besides us, late though it is. I came in here as instructed by the ministers of the king. I am what they call a small personal gratification appropriate to your status. You will have seen me already. I was dancing upon the platform.
Oh, you were?
Yes, I was.
A most depraved performance.
Yes, it was.
And why should the ministers imagine that I would enjoy your company any further at close quarters?
I don't see why they shouldn't. Everyone else does.
Very possibly. But nonetheless, you had your hand upon my sack.
Oh, yes, sir. That was also according to instructions.
Then you better get out and be damned to you before I kick you out.
Oh, come on. You're half asleep still. How the devil would you have known I had my hand upon your sack? Unless I'd whispered in your ear that I had, so woke you up.
And that's a good point. Have we not got a light in here? I'd like to have a look at you.
No, we're striking no lights. There are no shutters to the window. What I was told to do, I should have done in the dark. If they see a light, they'll be suspicious. But move over into the moonlight. Now then, can you see me?
She was not beautiful, but her eyes were big, protuberant. They shone like the white of an egg. The hand by which she held me was wide, hot, and strong. Her lips were thick. Her nose was long. We were quite alone in a narrow, plastered room. Is there anyone listening outside the door?
There might be. Have a look.
Nobody there.
Good. Now, I'm going to tell you what they would kill me for if they heard of it. It will not have escaped your attention that the people of this town live a comfortable life.
True. And as I take it, you yourself are part of that comfort.
Nor yet that the people outside are dying of starvation.
That's true, too. And no one could deny that you have a belly on you like a tub of butter.
But you don't know why.
No.
So here is the secret. Make sure that you keep it. By right, I should compel you to swear a great oath to the burning of your flesh and the shedding of your blood. But I do not. So take note. It is not possible that I should be anything but stark, raving mad. So being mad, I will begin. In the very middle of this town is a deep, dark hole struck into the ground, kept well guarded and closed in by a roof of slate and a wall of stone. Day and night, selected men descend by ropes to dig and shovel, and what they find there as they grovel far underneath us in the dark keeps us as jovial as Midas when he touched the doorframe of his button, Ben, and turned each rotten timber post to what it was he wanted most. There is a cave of clay there, choked with jewels deep in the core of the rock, emeralds, rubies, brooches of gold. Every turn of the spade down there will unfold a crown or a coronet, a great plate or a goblet, or maybe just two or three pearls in a droplet, or a thick twist of silver wire for a necklet or armlet.
And how did it all get there?
How do you think? It was left there by rich men who were frightened and ran from some conqueror or other in the ancient times. We are told that these rich men have committed crimes, murdered and pillaged. For what other reason would they have gathered so much in so short a season? We call this dirty town the town of the murderer's treasure, and we live on it and live off it, and we make of it our pleasure.
So nobody has to do any work?
None of the citizens have to do any work.
And the outlandish men to whom you deny any share of your riches?
If they work for us, we feed them. But we don't need very much work.
Who are they?
Who do you think? You are too slow to understand what you ought to know. They are the original murderers who dug the hole and buried all that we dig up and all that we inherit. The citizens came in one bright year in the season of spring. They took everything they found, above and below the ground. They dwell in a town which they did not build, and they give the name of murderers to the men whom they killed.
Is it citizens, they? A minute ago you said we. Who are you?
I am betwixt and between. Neither the one nor the other. My father was outlandish. He crept in and took theft of my mother. And after that he went back to his old trade as a highway robber, an hereditary enemy of the town where his daughter was born. They let me live, and I can feed and survive without harm, but I must deserve my protection by obeying their every instruction. And whatever they do to me, I must have it done to me with charm.
You are a slave.
No more than they are. Because the treasure that they think is theirs isn't theirs at all. There's a great king across the water who takes as much of it as he wants and provides the citizens with food that ought to be being grown by the farms of the outlandish men, if they had farms, which once they had. He determines his own price for the treasure that is dug up. He has an ambassador in this town to supervise the diggings. And he appoints and pays and administers the horsemen who ride patrol. The ones who brought you into town. Oh, the whole economy of this region is entirely ridiculous. You wouldn't credit it if you met it in real life. But then, you are in a dream. And you've entirely abdicated, have you not, from the regiment of common sense.
I don't know about dreams. I dreamt I had a young woman in my bag to make love to me. But it wasn't so. Would you be inclined to make love to me now? I would like it if you would.
No, take your fingers away from where you're putting them, or I'll bite them off this minute. It's not that kind of a dream at all. You've fallen asleep at the wrong place and the wrong time. Besides, I was instructed to make love to you. And I've suddenly turned today into a mood of rebellion. You know why?
Why?
Because of your little men. And the wild memory they dredged up of who my father once was. And the strong defiance with which he lived. You send us more remembrances like that, little man. There'll be no protection left. No security. No good dinners. Nothing but the truth.
And at once I was alone in the room without any sign that she had been with me, except for the rancid smell of her breath in the air. Such bad breath they all had in this place. For a people who lived so voluptuously, but in what I now knew to be imminent peril, they were extremely indelicate over the detail of their common intercourse. I wished I was back in Muswell Hill. The whole situation was becoming most unpleasant. When I fell asleep, I had thought my dream would be the dream of a jellyfish in a warm and waveless sea. The gulf weed slowly stroking me on back and side. No turbulence to contradict the gentle ebbing of the tide. I was quite wrong. I was not strong. I did not think I could survive this kind of sleep. I staggered up and down, piercing my feet upon the splinters in the rough-cut floor. I flung open the door.
looked out into a passageway, and there was no one there. I said to myself, I will escape. I will run barefoot upon splinters and stones and thorns. By dint of the pain of it, I will surely awake. This town and its cruel people are made only of a vapor, of falsehood and dirt. I will awake from them and work, as is my custom, without confusion, upon a clean piece of white paper, in a clean, quiet house with the windows closed, and flowers upon the window sills elegantly disposed, and my wife between my white sheets, and my children in the green garden. 4 children and 1 sweet wife, every one of them with the name of Arden. Let me run quickly. Oh, God, how the soles of my feet have been torn.
Forgive me, but you go no further. I have orders to bring you and your bag directly to a person who is wanting to speak to you.
Oh, I haven't any shoes on. Let me go back to my room for my shoes.
Oh, no, that is not possible. Had you been sleeping peacefully, I would have awoken you with circumspection and let you dress yourself at leisure. But as it is, I have run into you in the grey light of dawn, apparently in process of making your escape. You are a guest of this city, sir. It is discourteous of you to attempt to evade us. Therefore, you must come with me, and at once, just as you are. Where is the young woman who was sent to your room to sleep with you?
I sent her away. I didn't want her. She wasn't attractive.
You're the first I've heard say so. Come with me, please.
He carried a black wand with a silver knob. Some sort of a tipstaff, no doubt. But there were 2 men behind him with clubs, so I could not refuse his invitation. I did put 1 nervous question. Where? To whom? Why?
You must not put questions to His Majesty's servants.
So, it was the king they were taking me to, was it? But they led me through no glorious forecourts and tall porticos of a palace, down 1 back corridor, across a dingy yard, up another corridor, docked through a storeroom amongst barrels and boxes, and so at length into a vestibule about the size of a large tea chest, and here we all 4 stopped. There was a 4-foot-high door in the whitewashed wall opposite us, and the tipstaff knocked cautiously, opened it, stuck his head in.
Just to check that they're all ready for you. Yes, they are. In you go.
And he pushed me in and went out himself, and the door was shut behind me.
Sit down. There's a stool in the corner.
A great big man with a face like a bucket of blood. He sat behind a table in a room surprisingly clean, painted and gilded, with life-size pictures of soldiers on every panel of the walls. Each soldier held a different sort of a weapon. The blade of every weapon had dark brown stains upon it. The faces of the soldiers were like wild animals with tusks. The sunrise was coming in through little windows high up near the ceiling. The great big man was eating eggs. He ate 7 eggs at once, and the yolk ran down his chin.
Now then, what's all this, then?
Your Majesty, I...
Don't call me Majesty. Only 1 Majesty in this town, boy, and he's too small.
You are in the presence, young gentleman, of the ambassador of the great king across the water.
A bespectacled secretary, with his face covered with cobwebs. He crouched in the dark behind the door, stabbing flies with his penknife. I hadn't noticed him when I came in.
You will address the ambassador as Excellence, because he is.
Though you hear who I am.
Yes, I do, Excellence.
Quiet! I am the enormous ambassador. I eat eggs and they make me fat. What do you do? Don't tell me, I've been told. You set afoot unauthorized imitations of people you should despise, and you blow them out like bullfrogs with the imagination of their strength. At the same time, however, you reserve to yourself a sharp pin with which you can, at your convenience, prick their distended bellies and explode them into nothing. The first part of your program, from my point of view, is abhorrent. From the point of view of the underdog people to whom you address yourself, the second part is likewise. Therefore, you are either very bold and a man to be objectively admired, or else you are a hedger and a fence-setter and a contemptible patroon, I wonder which. In any case, you're a man who deserves to be suppressed. But I'm not going to suppress you, no. Nor am I going to encourage you. I am going to regard you as a challenge and defy you to do your worst. In some sense, it may be said that a challenge to us in this place is both desirable and requisite. At least a challenge that we are aware of, for it will attract to its publicity the other occult challenges, which at present we have no cognizance, only suspicion.
Rather more than suspicion in several cases, Excellence. I am compiling, as you told me, all these dossiers, and there will be certain surprises in the fullness of time.
I don't want to hear them now. Boy, you sit there hostile upon my stool. Are you dumbfounded, or are you goddamn stubborn? Yes, he is stubborn, yes, he's bold. My God, we do admire him. Yes, we lack such men round here. You're going to shake me by the hand.
His hand had an egg in it. He thought it was funny. Raw yolk splashed up my sleeve and dribbled between my fingers. Then he threw another egg at the secretary. Hit him square upon the spectacles, streaked with white and yellow all the cobwebs across his face. At first I didn't know what the noise was. Then I realized it was the secretary laughing, because the ambassador was laughing. But now I heard this other noise I was not able to account for. But it was me laughing. I suppose I thought it was appropriate, and I didn't want to give offence. Never willingly give offence, not me. A disposition always, I thought, to be both meek and courteous. The next damned egg that the arrogant bastard threw landed right in the middle of my chest.
Eggs are full of gold. They stink when they are old. Scramble, boil, or poach, or fry. Long and hard, oh, you may try. You'll never scrape away the stain. The egg is mine, and you are mine. Go on, get out, goodbye.
The secretary got up. With a sudden and novel politeness, he threw open the door for me. Not the small back door by which I had entered, but the proper and painted door of state at the other side of the room. He ushered me out, all deference, into a lobby full of male and female dragonflies, or so it seemed. So elegant they were, gracefully waving their adorned bodies in this and that inconsequential gesture, one toward the other, and they chewed at little sweetmeats, took discreet sips of little drinks out of thimble-sized crystalware and buzzed, and then fell silent and smiled and winked at me as I passed through. I saw among them the two ministers whom I had seen the previous day, but no one else that I recognized. The two ministers were very gracious, smiling at me, but they said nothing. Everyone was looking at my bare feet and my untidy appearance. When all was said, this was the audience chamber of the palace of the king, and I was dressed for nothing better than the evening standard in Muswell Hill. Yet there was no malice, there was no scorn, there was a kind of respect about their looks. Just so, I could hear them thinking. Comes arrayed the man who holds within his bag the lovely secrets of our lives. So intimate his burden, so abrupt and unmannerly his looks. They found the contrast quite delicious. Then there was a... a trumpet, out of Shakespeare, as it were. And the king came in, and the queen, and various other members of the royal family. I don't know who they were. Everyone knelt down, except for me. I was a Republican, I said to myself, and I would go on my knees for no man. But I felt a certain embarrassment after standing alone for a long minute, and I began to bend my knees like everyone else, but half-heartedly, in order to show my disapproval of these forms. But the king spoke.
I see you do not kneel.
I straightened up again quickly. If he hadn't noticed my beginning to bend, then I might as well appear to be consistent in my disapproval.
No, sir, I do not. I'm a Republican, you see.
Yes, you would be. I suppose we all are these days, are we not? Though you would get a dusty reception in the palace of my cousin, the great king, over the water. But he is a barbarian, really. His ambassador's not coming yet?
No, Your Majesty, not yet.
Thank goodness for that. Very well then, young man. Professor, are you called? You may open your bag again and begin. We are yours to command.
Then they all sat down, put their hands upon their laps, and looked expectantly at me. Somebody clapped, but was immediately shushed. I bowed to them, smiled, opened up the bag, took out the little men, and laid them down upon the polished floorboards in a row, just as before. And just as before, the cantankerous dragon inside me began to give tongue.
My little people in a row, sit on the stage and watch the show. The show they watch is rows and rows of people watching them.
But I felt less at ease than on the previous occasion. I had reminded myself then of Adolf Hitler. Hitler in his prime, at a Nuremberg rally, perhaps. Now, if I was Hitler, it was Hitler in the Berlin bunker of 1945. And the boots of the Red Army were stamping above my head. But I got through it, and I got on with it, and the little people began their story. Not at all the same story. I was amazed at their metamorphosis. They were not even the same sort of people as before. There was a king and a queen and a bishop, yes. But the soldier and the constable and the housewife and the ragged men were all gone. Their places had been taken by a crowd of posturing exquisites, dolled up in peacock feathers and waterfalls of gold and silver lace. And there was no fighting in the story. Nothing but extraordinary variations of erotic postures and intrigues, couplings and triplings and quadruplings, men and women together, men and men, women and women, women and men, women. While the audience muttered and laughed and clapped a little and conversed with one another, some of them walked out. The music was erotic also, but more than a little insipid. At the end, when all the diverse and perverse setting to partners had been in a manner resolved, there was a courteous but unenthusiastic applause. And I felt ashamed. First, because I hadn't liked the entire narrative from beginning to end, and secondly, because the audience hadn't liked it very much either. Or so at least I believed. But when half an hour afterwards I found myself closeted as an honored guest in a small and private room with no other than the king and queen, I began to wonder if I hadn't been mistaken. The king was no more slender than the general run of his subjects, but he was gentle and timorous and kind-hearted. The queen was soft and dewy. You could almost call her silly, if she hadn't been wearing a crown.
So very glad to have this opportunity of speaking to you, my dear professor.
So different from what we thought you would have been.
But the exhibition itself, the little men, I mean...
Not at all what we expected.
Oh? What did you expect, Your Majesty?
Something much more, much more...
Much more flattering, His Majesty means.
We never speak to anybody except flatterers and panderers. It was quite a relief to hear the truth about ourselves.
Yes, it made us squirm.
Indeed, yes.
I did not know whether or not I was expected to say anything.
Yes, I try to do my best... Your Majesty?
So you do. Yes.
Yes. Tomorrow, at the same time.
The audience being over, I was shown to the breakfast room where I ate a huge meal. And the next day, at the same time, I went through the same performance. And the next day. And the next day. And for days upon days, so it seemed, though there was a kind of odd telescopic effect about the progress of time, and in some way, I wasn't certain but that only a few hours had passed. When I wasn't employed in demonstrating my powers before the assembled royalty and courtiers, I was left to enjoy myself in the gardens of the palace. For so it was called by everyone. For all that, it was no more than a collection of well-decorated summer houses, cleaner than the town outside it, but in no sense monumental. Yet gardens it did have, and they were furnished with silver fountains and marble tables laden with food and drink,
and plenty of sumptuous girls reclining in their jewels who didn't have anything interesting to say but permitted me all manner of familiarity whenever I wanted it. It was all very indolent and agreeable and very much beside the point.
And that is a true word. Not only beside the point, you are entirely beside yourself. Wake up!
I am awake. You're always waking me. It's no business of yours. And in any case, I don't believe you have permission to be in the king's private garden.
Private garden? Turn your sleepy head from left to right. Tell me what you find here in your sight.
I turn my head from left to right, right round, and find myself on a gravelly patch of ground, strewn with cinders and old rags, rusty buckets, broken jugs. Where is the fountain? Where is the green grass? Where are the girls whom I dreamed that I did kiss? Where is the king who spoke to me so kindly? Can this be his bright palace, all this rubbish piled around me?
Within your dream, you fell asleep again.
But when did I fall asleep? When did it go wrong?
Look at your shirt, boy. Look at that yellow stain.
The egg of the ambassador. Was that the first or the second dream?
That was the true dream. Now I'll show you the true king.
And stooping through brambles and bits of broken wall and old fences made of useless bedsteads, she brought me secretly by back ways to a derelict shed like a hen house. You see many such if you go to Dagenham or Romford on the top deck of a London bus. Hundreds of them scattered all over the allotments. Sordid enough, but useful for the men who grow cabbages when not working in the factories. But there was no cabbage patch here. And the window of the shed was nailed up with creosoted boards. We looked in through a chink between these, and it was all dark inside the shed.
For the liberty of the people! For the liberty of the people! Oh, God, is there nobody who will give me a drink of water?
Who is it? Who have they got in there? Is he chained to the wall or what?
Chained to the wall, and has been for 20 years. When they remember, they give him something to eat and drink. That is the king, and this is all that is left of his palace. Now, we best get out of here before we're caught by the guard.
Who goes there? Oh,
shh! It's too late. Get down among the nettles.
Stay where you are. Who goes? Come out of that and declare yourselves.
No. Not yet. Not time to declare ourselves yet. Put your hand out to the left. What do you find?
There's an iron ring fixed into a flagstone.
I said come out of that. I can see you. All right, then. You want it the hard way? Get the dogs! There's two intruders!
Pull at it, you fool! It'll come up if you pull strongly. Oh, for God's sake, look sharp with it.
It's difficult. The clay all round seems to have set hard. Got it open.
Down into it. Quick. What the devil are you playing at?
Well, my bag. I can't leave my bag.
Oh, God, you'll have to leave your bag. You idiot, you can't...
No. I have it. Here we are.
Safe and sound. There's boats underneath the trap. Huh? Shut them.
Damn rusty. Oh. Do they know about this place? Did they see where we went under?
I don't think so. They'd have seen us go in among the bushes... And with the dogs, they'll soon find the trap. So it can't ever be used again. There was a project, never got anywhere, to rescue the old king this way. And now, of course, it's finished. Oh, but it wasn't any good. The old king's no good to anyone. The fact of the matter is, there's nobody any good to anybody. Nobody and nothing. Except to burn the whole town down. We'll have to do it one of these days. Easy enough, all made of wood. But for some reason, nobody wanted to. Afraid I shouldn't wonder. Though they said they were too humane.
Where are we?
We're in a disused drain pipe. All the old drains in this town are disused. You could tell that from the smell when you walked about the streets.
Well, can we get out anywhere?
Not conveniently. It used to lead to the river, but it's been blocked with dead dogs and so on. There are other trapdoors. We'll find a good one and climb up that way. But we'd better wait till after nightfall. And would you leave that bloody bag behind you? You're going to get stuck in the passageways or goodness knows what. As it is, you've already nearly got both of us caught with it.
I can't leave it. Whatever would I do without it?
Just the same as the rest of us. Fight.
Fight?
But I didn't come here to fight. I was given this bag to... Look, I paid for this bag. Gave all the money I had in my pocket. Don't you see that it's all I have?
Which is more than any of the rest of us have. We don't need it. You don't. Get rid of it.
And who do you think you're talking about? The rest of you. It's the first time I've heard...
It's the first time you could have possibly heard it. It's the first time I've ever said it. The first time it has ever happened. This is not just a matter of little gangs of bold marauders. God rest my father's soul, but that was all he was. No, it is even unity. Controlled and organized resistance. We're solidly put together, we're under discipline, and we look for power. By God, for the first time for how many hundreds of years, we're going to get power in our own hands.
For the liberty of the people!
And there they all were, crowded in a close, dark, underground cavern, their emaciated faces lit by flaring torchlight, their fists clenched toward the roof in fantastic ecstasy, their purposeful bodies hung with weapons of every size and variety, from flint axes and bows and arrows to great rusty blunderbuss guns. My young woman, my lascivious dancer, she who had been instructed both to spy upon me and seduce me, now dragged me by force forward into the middle of them all, and without consulting me, proclaimed me to be their brother.
He is our brother!
Hooray!
No, you don't know that at all. And if indeed you are preparing an insurrection in this catacomb, may I tell you that your sense of security leaves a great deal to be desired? As far as you are concerned, I'm a complete stranger. Yet you bring me into your midst of you and reveal to me your plans. You must be mad.
Not at all.
I could betray you.
Not at all, for you're asleep. This is your dream. How can you betray what you've done no more than dream about?
Oh. Very well, then. Provided that that is clearly understood by all parties.
Well, yes, of course.
So, in my dream, I ask of you to tell me what I am to do. Outlandish men who rise in anger against the tyrant and the oppressor, what do you want from the lonely stranger? Beyond that I should share your danger, in, of course, so far as I can, lumbered as I am with this most discommodious but necessary burden.
Your burden is no good to us. Throw it down. Take up a weapon.
This is my weapon. You have your spears and knives. I have these images of your proud lives. Here in your secret hold, your dangerous den, I straightway dedicate to you my little men.
Hooray!
So I tore open the sack and tipped them out in front of the company. I was exalted. My heart burned with zeal. I was not a fighter. I was no conspirator. I had no power but this power, and I was giving it all to the cause. There was nothing of Hitler in my voice this time. Savonarola, perhaps, or Oliver Cromwell on the Drake Moorland of Dunbar.
My little people in a row, sit on the stage and watch the show.
I looked down at them in amazement. They were all clustering and huddling together, some of them struggling to get back into the bag. They had the appearance of a whole colony of ants distressed beyond their wits when a violent boot breaks into their anthill.
What are you doing? Why do you not respond to me? You have your business to perform. For God's sake, get on with it. Why do you put me to shame before all these men of war?
Men of war do not require to see themselves in a truthful mirror. All that they need to spur them to action is their own most bloody reflection in the white eyeballs of their foe.
We are neat and well-considered little people.
If you bring us into battle, you bring us only unto grief and woe. Fracture and breakage that we cannot repair. They will snap our wooden joints
and pull out our cotton hair.
Please let us get back into the sack.
When the battle has been won, we can peep out again
and creep back.
Comrades, stand to your weapons. We're betrayed. The enemy's upon us. We've got into the tunnel.
We're betrayed by this fool with his bag.
He's wasted our time and distracted our attention. I warned him! I warned him! He must not bring it here!
And in an instant, all was blood and death and furious weapons swung at random in the dark. The young woman who had brought me there was struck down at the first onslaught. I endeavored to get between her and the soldier who was beating her to the ground, but he thrust me aside with a great backhand blow. I fell down upon my sack and upon the squirming heap of my terrified little men. A huge foot, shod with steel, stamped hard upon my temple. And that was the end of my dream. I awoke upon the platform of the Highgate Underground Station. A train was just departing. The passengers thronged in and out. The porter at back of the crowd gave his customary shout.
Maintenance! Maintenance, please!
I staggered, a forsworn traitor, to the foot of the escalator. I mounted the moving stair, came out into the upper air. In my hand, I held a bag. It was a kit bag from the army. I looked in it. It was quite empty. I dropped it in a litter box and walked home sideways like a slinking fox. At the corner of Muswell Hill by the National Provincial Bank stood an ancient gypsy beggar woman with black hair long and lank. She spoke to me in an undertone. I made no doubt she was only asking for the price of a bunch of white heather, but the roar of the traffic distorted her voice, and all I heard was what she could not possibly have uttered.
You did not find what you expected. What you found, you did not use. What you saw, you did not look at. When you looked at it, you would not choose.
So I pushed past her and went home. If I had been defeated, it was all in a dream. But the fat men and the thin men stood all around me in the street. I could not carry a fat man's body upon a thin man's feet. It would have been easy, it would have been good, to have carried a bag full of solid food and fed the thin men till they were as fat as the men who held them in fear. But such is not the nature of these bags that are given away by old women in rags. But such is not my nature, nor will be. All I can do is to look at what I see.
In John Arden's play The Bagman, or The Impromptu of Muswell Hill, Sheila Allen was the young woman and Hilda Kreisman the old woman. The popular minister was played by Geoffrey Matthews, the unpopular minister by Hector Ross. The King by Austin Trevor, the Queen by Margaret Wolfitt, and the Ambassador by Peter Pratt. Others taking part included Maddie Head, Sonia Fraser, Sean Barrett, Wilfred Carter, John Rye, David Spencer, Leonard Fenton, and Kerry Francis. The narrator was Alan Dobie. The music and special effects were provided by the BBC's Radiophonic Workshop, and the play was directed by Martin Eslin.